Okay, your turn.
To talk about something also up to date, being the latest crisis with Iraq, probably saw the issue of Time magazine with Saddam Hussein and Bill Clinton. Hussein looking very much like the devil, and Clinton facing his showdown. There's kind of ominous implications. I never thought I'd be quoting Brzezinski for something, but McLaughlin, of course, himself has been rather critical of the sanctions. In fact, even called them genocidal.
Who called them that?
McLaughlin, of course.
Oh, the television, yeah.
Conservative program. He was quite adamant about that and mm-hmm. quoted figures that hadn't been quoted much in the media. Well, Brzezinski said, of course, he was asked about all these weapons, and he said, well, we fought the Cold War, and the Soviet Union had much more extensive weapons, and we weren't worried about that, and there's something called deterrence, which prevents countries from using these weapons. So I don't see why we're so worried about it. Now, my question is, it seems to be something of a more rational theme than the hysteria that was whipped up in the media about this. So my question is, why are they so concerned about what's going on in Iraq right now? I mean,
well, it's certainly not the weapons. That we can be certain about. Because they had the same weapons up till 19, almost the same weapons up till 1990. And they were getting them from us, and from England, and from Germany, and from France. And nobody was worried about them then, because Saddam Hussein was a real nice guy. He was one of our major friends and trading partners. George Bush, the Bush administration, was in fact getting around congressional restrictions to continue pouring aid and credits on their good friend Saddam Hussein. In some way, it's not just the weapons that they weren't concerned about, it's also the terror. Almost all of Saddam Hussein's a monster, but virtually all of his crimes were committed then. You know, the extra crimes during the invasion of Kuwait were very slight. Like the gassing of the Kurds, which now everyone is supposed to be angry about. You weren't supposed to be angry about in 1988 when it was going on, because then we were supporting Saddam Hussein. So it didn't matter if he was gassing Kurds, or the torture of dissidents and the rest of it and so on. That was all while he was our boy, you know. So it can't, we can rule a few things out. The problem isn't the weapons. The problem isn't the terror and the violence. It's something else. Well, you can even proceed further. Is it something that changed radically when he invaded Kuwait? Well, in a sense, yes. He disobeyed orders, and you're not allowed to do that. But did the United States turn against him when he invaded Kuwait? Well, you can check that out easily enough. The so-called war, I don't think it's a good name for it, but what's called the Gulf War, ended in early March 1991. Okay, at that point, the U.S. forces stopped fighting. Saddam Hussein didn't stop. He immediately turned to huge massacres. There was an uprising in the south of Iraq, Shiite uprising, with rebelling Iraqi generals, in fact, you know, trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein, popular uprising to overthrow Saddam Hussein in the south, right under the eyes of Stormin Norman Schwarzkopf, you know, U.S. Army sitting there, total control, you know, of everything. This uprising is going on. Rebelling Iraqi generals were pleading with the United States to just not to help, but just to allow them to have access to captured military equipment. U.S. refused, flatly refused. I refused to offer them any help whatsoever. Sat by quite happily while Saddam Hussein massacred and suppressed the rebellion in the south. Towns like Basra were probably more destroyed by Saddam's attack, you know, under our eyes, helping him out tacitly, than during the so-called war. He then moved on. The same thing then happened in the north. There was a Kurdish uprising, same thing. United States stood by quietly. Something different happened in the north. The north, there began to be some there was no publicity about the south. Besides, they were just a bunch of dirty Arabs anyway, so nobody really cared. The north was a little bit different. The Kurds are Aryans. And if you remember the television reporting, I don't know why you remember that, but it was quite striking. I mean, television reporters would go and say, look what's happening to these blue-eyed, blonde children just like ours, you know, monstrous, and so on and so forth. For whatever reason, partly just racism, partly other reasons, there was publicity going around about the massacres in the north. And the Bush administration was forced to take some steps. Didn't do much, but they declared a no-fly zone and, you know, did some things to terminate the massacres in the north. If you look at what's happened since, basically they're letting the Kurds go down the tube. They're supporting Turkish invasions and so on. Well, that's Saddam Hussein, is it? And in fact, if you go back to spring of 1991, for not just Brzezinski, but even the mainstream press was pretty straight about it. Thomas Friedman, who's the chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times at the time, and a Middle East specialist, he explained why, he's a sort of State Department spokesman in the New York Times, what it amounts to. He explained why the United States was supporting Saddam Hussein as he was crushing the rebellions, and he said, well, I said, we need stability. Everybody said that. The main thing we need is stability. You know, it's a good thing. So what does stability mean? He says, well, the best thing, what the United States would really like, he said, is an, this is virtually a quote, is an iron-fisted military junta which would rule Iraq the same way Saddam Hussein did before he stepped out of line. That would be the top priority. But we can't quite get that because it's kind of embarrassing to have Saddam Hussein there. So the next best would be to have an iron-fisted military junta which would rule Iraq the way Saddam Hussein did, but with somebody else doing it. Well, we couldn't quite get, you know, that's what we're going to try to get. And the worst thing that would be possible would be a democracy. In fact, right through this period, the U.S. was refusing, and to my knowledge still is refusing, to have any contact with Iraqi Democrats. You take a look through the whole period of the, you know, the build-up to the Kuwait War, and, you know, the Gulf War, and huge publicity and everything. Ask yourself how often Iraqi Democrats appeared in the United States press. I'll give you the answers. You don't have to bother looking. Zero. There are plenty of them. The first break in, and it's not that they were kind of dangerous radicals or anything. They're mostly conservatives. So the head of the Iraqi Democratic Movement is a London banker, you know, Ahmed Chalabi. He finally was allowed an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was around April 1991, you know, after the war was over. I think that was the first break. And the State Department was saying straight out when asked, we will not have contact with Iraqi Democrats because that would be interfering in the internal affairs of Iraq. And, you know, we don't do things like that. I mean, same. And so whatever's going on, it's none of these things. So what is going on? Look, Saddam Hussein broke rules. One of the rules of world order is you do what you're told. Okay? You want to murder gas Kurds, you know, murder dissidents, crush Shiites and so on, that's fine because we're in favor of that. But we didn't want you to, and in fact the United States even pretty much told them, we don't mind if you rectify the borders with Kuwait, you know, like some disputed borders, okay, you know, move a little bit, shake your fist and raise the oil prices, we don't care about that. But taking over a core element of the U.S.-British wealth system, that's not allowed. Kuwait was, this is all discussed in much detail in declassified documents, which any sane reporter or scholar would have instantly looked at when the Gulf War began from 1958, when Iraq broke out of the Western-dominated system. There was a huge, you know, the tremendous turmoil in Britain and the United States. The documents are declassified. And there was a lot of discussion. So the British Foreign Secretary flew to Washington, had big debates with discussions with Dulles. They decided what to do. And what they decided to do was played out almost exactly during the Gulf War. They decided that the British should, Kuwait was then a British colony. They said they should give Kuwait nominal independence because that would cut back the threat of nationalism, of independent nationalism. They were afraid that Iraqi nationalism was Nasserite, you know, it was part of the Jim. They didn't worry about the communists. There was kind of a growth of radical Arab nationalism in the region. It couldn't be allowed to spread. They then decided that if anything, Kuwait is a major source for British wealth. You know, the Kuwaiti investment councils in London, the whole way the Middle East oil system works is that the profits from oil have to go to the West. They're not allowed to go to the people of the region. And the role of the ruling elites is essentially to ensure that those profits go to the West. Britain, which is the junior partner, gets Kuwait and a few other small places. The United States, the big guy, gets the big one, like Saudi Arabia. The profits come here. They concluded that Kuwait should be given nominal independence, and if anything happens, even internal to Kuwait, which affects British domination, U.S.-British domination, Britain, and with U.S. backing, should ruthlessly intervene to suppress it. And the United States would do the same in the rest of the Arabian Peninsula. So if anything disturbs this arrangement, we will ruthlessly intervene to break it up and restore order in our terms. That doesn't matter whether it's internal, external, anything. Incidentally, no Russians. You know, they made it very explicit there's no Russian involvement. Well, okay, that happened in 1990. Iraq extended, went too far. They didn't just rectify the borders, but they took over Kuwait, and the U.S. and Britain ruthlessly intervened to restore the status quo ante. Now Saddam Hussein has to be punished, because you don't get away with that. Of course, the punishment doesn't affect him. It's, you know, what was called genocide. And in fact, nobody knows the details, but the Western estimates are that maybe 500,000 or more children have been killed, and probably 1 million or more people by the sanctions, which have only strengthened Saddam Hussein, because they've undermined any possibility of popular reaction to him. And if there's any democratic movement that's going to try to overthrow him, that'll probably continue to be opposed by the United States. There are other things going on too. Oil prices are fairly low at the moment. In fact, gas prices at the U.S. pumps are now lower in real terms than they have ever been since 1950, believe it or not. The price of a gallon of oil is less now than it was in 1950. You know, not numbers, but real numbers. The U.S., it's often said that the U.S. wants to keep the oil price from rising, but that's only half true. It also wants to keep it from falling. Oil prices have to stay within a certain range. You don't want to go too high, because that's harmful to the Western industrial societies, but you don't want it to go too low, because that cuts into the interests, to the profits for the energy companies, which are mostly U.S. and secondarily Britain. And that's a big flow of capital to the United States. Furthermore, the profits from oil, like, you know, Saudi Arabian princes and so on, make a lot of profits. That usually ends up in the U.S. Treasury. I mean, it's either in Treasury securities or in purchases of weapons or in, you know, huge construction programs for Bechtel or something like that, or in just in U.S. and British banks. So the oil price has to be kept within a certain range. And policy has largely been designed to sort of keep it there. If Iraqi oil started flowing into the market, the price would go way down. You know? I'm speculating, because of course these are unaccountable systems. You know, they don't tell you what they're doing, and they never release documentation. It's not like a government, which maybe 30 or 40 years from now will tell you something about what it was doing. This is pure secrecy. These are tyrannies. But it looks like that's what's happening, that's my guess.
So how would that be punished for us? You need to ensure the stability that you want.
Because they're still hoping for the first best option, an iron-fisted junta without Saddam Hussein. And, you know, maybe that'll come along. Maybe some other thug like him will overthrow him, you know. To the extent that it happens, yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, if there's a state airline, who's running it? Well, the people of the country are running it. Okay, but that's democracy. Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, in fact, you know, whether the people of the country are running it or not depends on what kind of a state it is. To the extent that the state is democratic, you know, which is, it's not a yes-no thing. It has a lot of dimensions and varies. But to the extent that the state is democratic, public institutions are influenced by, or their policies are determined by, the public. It's kind of like a triviality.
The argument is, if there are some influence in the public, then
Sure, but that's like saying that we should try to get Hitler back, because in a totalitarian state run by Hitler, there were plenty of benefits. In fact, Hitler carried out a social revolution. Germans were much better off than they were before. He was the most popular leader in German history right through the 1930s. If he'd been killed in 1939, he would have gone down in history as, you know, one of the great leaders of Germany. Yeah. Stalin also was a brutal dictator, but he industrialized Russia. You know, Russians were a lot better off than they had been before, the ones who survived, you know. And most of them did, and in fact he was pretty popular, you know. Yeah, it's certainly true that there are times when brutal totalitarian dictators do bring about improvements, and that could be true of private tyrannies too. On the other hand, you should also ask yourself whether it's true. I mean, is there evidence, real evidence, that transferring management from public control to private control increases efficiency? That's a little tricky, because when you begin to look, you find a lot of other things. For example, in places where the society sort of functions kind of more or less honestly and well, you know, say Sweden or Chile for that matter, public institutions are pretty efficient. So there is no pressure in Chile to privatize the biggest exporter, because it's very efficient. Where there's pressure to privatize, it's usually coming from private power, okay, not on grounds of efficiency. And in fact, if you look at the effects, it's very unclear what they are. So take the Brazilian steel industry. I mean, it was nationalized, always ran at a loss, okay, so it looks inefficient by some measure. On the other hand, part of the reason it was running at a loss was because it was purposely, by state policy, producing steel cheaply for the benefit of private manufacturers. So it was a public subsidy to private manufacturers, which made the steel industry look inefficient, right? But for the economy, it might not at all have been inefficient. And when you proceed, that's what you find. So like in England, which is, you know, a modern country, they privatized the water system recently. And by economists' measures, it's probably more efficient. On the other hand, people aren't getting water. Poor people don't get water, you know. Yeah, in fact, that's efficient. Like if you were put in charge of the water distribution system and you're an automaton, all human feelings are gone, your only interest is maximizing profit, well, you know perfectly well what you'd do. You'd cut out water altogether for people who, you know, can't pay for it, or are sort of not in some dense area which has a lot of money. Why should they have water at all? I mean, after all, they can go walk somewhere with a bucket on their back and get water. That's probably better by the macroeconomic statistics. So it's more efficient. And in fact, case after case, when you look at privatization, you find an extremely mixed picture. What you usually find is transfer of costs to the public. So take, say, privatization of roads. Well, you know, privatization of roads would mean you'd pay tolls if you're rich enough, and you'd go on nice highways. And if you're not rich enough to pay the tolls, well, you know, find your way down a dirt rut somewhere. You know, the total, the economy might look much better. Gross national product would go up, macroeconomic statistics would look good. For most of the people, it'd be terrible. It's forced on them. Forced on them from the outside. And it might be a good thing or it might be a bad thing, but you have to look at the cases. So, for example, just recently, Brazil privatized the Vale, you know, big, huge industrial mining conglomerate. They sold it off to private power. Well, you know, that's a large part of the future of Brazil is there. Brazil has plenty of resources. There was an analysis of Vale done by, there were two analyses of the value of it. One was done by Merrill Lynch. That's the one the government was using. Merrill Lynch also happens to be, you know, the agent for a lot of the private purposers and purchases and so on. Another was done by the engineering department at the Federal University in Rio. Good, serious people. I know some of them. I was down there about a year ago talking. Very serious industrial engineers and those people. They gave an evaluation of Vale which was far higher, taking into account future needs, you know, what would iron and gold and so on be worth 20 years from now to the people of Brazil and so on. Those considerations weren't taken into account by Merrill Lynch, of course, but they're real. Well, you know, it was sold off, and now private power will make the profit. I can just tell you this much. If you look at the, take a look at today's rich countries and today's poor countries, first world and third world, go back a couple hundred years, you find they weren't very different. In fact, India was the commercial and manufacturing center of the world in the 18th century. As late as the late 19th century, the British were deeply concerned by the fact that British textiles couldn't compete with Chinese textiles because they were much better and better done and so on. They changed. You know, Egypt started to undergo an industrial revolution about the same time the United States did, with comparable prospects. You know, they had their own cotton, big agricultural area, and so on. Well, you take a look at what happened since the 18th century. Two regions have developed outside of Europe, the United States and Japan. They are exactly the two regions which were able to fend off European control. Okay, the U.S. separated itself. Japan was able to fend off European control. Japan's had the highest growth rate in the world since the Meiji Restoration around 1860. The United States grew very fast. How did they do it? Same way Europe did, by radically interfering with market principles. So from the very beginning, the United States was super protectionist, had massive, you know, large-scale state subsidies and so on and so forth. Britain had done exactly the same. That's how it became the richest country in the world. Every other industrial developing country has done more or less the same thing. I mean, they use somewhat different methods. Like Japan happened to be much more liberal in trading than the United States was. But on the other hand, it had, you know, more authoritarian internal systems. So they vary in one way or another. But invariably, I think there is no exception to this, they did it by sharp interference with market principles. What about the third world? They had what's called neoliberalism is not liberalism, and it's not new. They've had it rammed down their throats for hundreds of years, and that turned them into the third world. Well, one aspect of that is the kind of privatization which leaves power in the hands of usually foreign industry or their local counterparts. We've just seen it go on in Mexico. Mexico's had the biggest privatization in modern history in the last, you know, actually the biggest privatization in history probably is the internet and the whole telecommunication system. Here is a system developed at public expense, which is being given, you know, it's not even sold. Privatization, sometimes they sell it for something. Here we just give it away, you know, to private power. So that's huge privatization. But in third world countries, I suppose the main case is Mexico. And in fact, yeah, it's true, the Mexican telephone company and so on, they're getting privatized. And you're getting a small, couple hundred billionaires, you know, service isn't improving except for the rich, getting a small number of billionaires. Wages and incomes have collapsed by, you know, can say a measure, but maybe 50% during the liberalization period. In 1995, right after the collapse, GNP went down by about 8 or 9%, still not recovering. Yeah, that's privatization. On the other hand, sometimes it might be the right thing to do. You know, like maybe it would be, but you need an argument. And the argument's complicated. The principle that says it's a wonderful thing, always do it, that's just, you know, that's not even religion. That's just pure doctrine. It's kind of like Stalinist doctrine. There's no reason to believe it. Sometimes it might be right, sometimes it might be wrong. And right or wrong don't mean anything either. Something can be right for some people and wrong for other people. Yeah, that's right. No, not to eradicate. Well, see, the World Bank gives you two contradictory... Take a look at World Bank programs. They have two contradictory messages. Totally contradictory. On the one hand, the World Bank does say consistently and forcefully that the path to economic growth requires relative equality, human capital, you know, so improving health and education and so on, improving infrastructure and relative equality. Those are the primary factors that are involved in growth. That's one side of their mouths. With the other side of their mouths, they're imposing policies which bar all of those things. So structural, whatever, you may like structural adjustment or hate it, But nobody doubts that what it does is reduce expenditures for health and welfare, increase inequality, cut back infrastructure, in fact, undermine exactly the factors that the World Bank and the other side of its mouth says are necessary for growth. And privatization is part of that. Simply ask yourself a question. Whatever debates you can have about privatization, there is one group of people that definitely gain by it, namely the people who are picking up the pieces. Okay. Well, they happen to be the same people who are making the policies. That should at least cause some question to arise.
I want to make a comment on that. I am from Mexico, and perhaps it's not as statistically significant, but prior to the privatization of Telmex, you had a phone line. You could wait for 3 years.
That's right. And now you don't have to.
Myself. You had to give them bottles of alcohol. You had to bribe the workers to get them to install a phone line. You could take 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And now it's much faster.
Right now, you order a phone line. Within 24 hours, you have a phone line.
Who ordered?
Anyone.
Yeah, anyone, except that for 95% of the population, it's out of the question.
Well, Mexico has more phone lines now than ever.
Yeah, that's right. It has a rich sector which is being well provided. But public phones, that's
no,
not happening.
Town, I experienced it myself. I worked this summer in the government state, and you can see all the poor people living in the very... In high school, I went to the Sierra. Mm. I had to walk there. Now they have homes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't buy that argument. I also don't buy the argument not helping.
Not helping
GDP,
who?
Mexico's GDP last year, 34% went to exports. If it hadn't been for exports, the economy would be really collapsing.
Yeah, that's right.
It created so many industries.
Mm.
So
but let's take a close look. Yes, exports increased to pay off the debt. You know, for most of the population, take a look at what's happened. For most of the population, average wages have declined quite radically. Depends exactly how you measure, but roughly in the 50% range declined since the liberalization began. Malnutrition has gone way up. Starvation has gone up. Millions of people have been driven off the land because they've been undercut by subsidized U.S. agro exports. There is production in regions which are in the Maquila regions primarily, which have virtually no linkage to the Mexican economy. They don't use Mexican inputs. About the only thing that they contribute to the Mexican economy is whatever the wages are. Environmental conditions have gotten much worse. But for a sector of the population, you know, the wealthier sector, surely things are better. That's true of every third world country. You go to sub-Saharan Africa, the same thing is true. There's a sector of the population that lives extremely well, in fact, that lives by Western standards, and there's a large mass of the population which is somewhere between suffering and misery. And for the wealthier part of the population, there is no doubt that these policies improve things. It's the same everywhere. For that part of the population, yes, these policies improve things. When you say that Mexico is living off exports, that's true. On the other hand, the growth rate in Mexico is much faster prior to 1980. It's declined since then. And you have to ask yourself what alternative policies are not being followed. Okay. Of course, there's always improvement. You know, there's always technical improvement. There's always more phones. There's always, you know, more airplanes and so on. What you have to ask yourself is, what are the net effects of carrying out this specific form of change? Well, it has varied effects for different parts of the population. It certainly has improved things for the wealthier sector, and it's harmed things for the majority.
Well, I could say what I saw is. In one state where I live, in this last year, 500,000 people that didn't get drinkable water are getting it for the first time. It's a state of 4 million people. So,
who are they getting it from?
Biggest increase. And also, you're going to get the first city in Mexico with treatment water. So pollution is going down.
No, it's going up, actually. All over all Mexico, it's going up. Excuse me. Go ahead.
The paper today confirmed. the leader of the opposition party to be the mayor of Mexico City, and Marcos that field was central.
You weren't talking about Mexico City, were you? Yeah. But with Mexico City, it's true, the opposition won. But, you know, you'll find places where things are getting better. You find other places where they're getting worse. On the average, they're getting worse. And that's particularly striking when you compare the development of Mexico up till 1980, when it was, in fact, a rapid growth period. Just, in fact, very much the same as East Asia. So, yeah, it separates. But for people like us, you know, yeah, in most of the third world, people like us live very well. Most of the population are like the ones in Roxbury. They don't. And for them, it's getting worse. In the case of, say, privatization of the Mexican telephone, I think you have to look at it on its own. You have to look at what the consequences were. Of course, it's an attack on democracy. That's by definition. Any kind of privatization is. But sometimes it could be that an attack on democracy is beneficial to people, and sometimes it might not be. You have to look closely and see what happened, where resources went, what the alternatives were, what people are paying for it, and so on and so forth. That's what you have to look at. Same is true when you look at, say, take right here, deregulation of airlines. Is it beneficial or not beneficial? Well, actually, there's been quite a big debate about that. I mean, it's true that airplanes are faster, and there are more of them, and they're safer, but that was going on before deregulation. So what you have to show is that there's a point of inflection, you know, the things. And in fact, what you find is, yeah, there were changes, but they're in all directions. So one of the changes, for example, is that the number of heart attacks has gone way up. Because people are now crammed into such close quarters that they end up with embolisms. Another is that the cheapest way to get from Boston to Washington is probably through London because of the way the privatized air fares work out. There's all kinds of changes, and you really have to measure them all. And some of them are very hard to measure. So, for example, one change which shows up in the statistics as an improvement is automation of services in the airlines. It's like you call an airline office, you know, and you get into an automated menu. And, you know, ultimately, if you work through it, if you're lucky, you get what you want. That saves money. That makes the airlines much more efficient because they don't have to pay human beings to sit there and answer what you're saying, right? So when an economist looks at it, they say, a lot more efficient than it used to be. But that's because of the ideological technique of measurement. They're not measuring what it costs you, you know, the person who's calling up, to sit there for half an hour while you sort of wait for, you know, to get onto the computer and then to start pushing the buttons, which you don't understand, and they don't have your answer anyway, so on. Well, that's a cost to a person. The cost to people, to users, is multiplied by the number of users. Well, it could be a substantial cost, maybe small to each person, but huge when you multiply it by the number of users. But it's unmeasured. The only thing that is measured is the increase of efficiency in the airlines, which shows up in their costs. So, yeah, it looks good. Well, those are things you really have to take into account, and they're not small. I mean, there have been few attempts to study them. It's not a popular topic. But there have been a few attempts to study, for example, the cost of highway repairs as compared repair of cars. Well, the few studies are around seem to indicate that the cost of repairing highways is considerably lower than the total cost of repairing cars because of hitting potholes and so on. But the second cost is not counted. It's only the first cost that's counted. The first cost is a cost of the inefficiency of government spending money on, you know, on highways. The second cost is distributed over the population. In fact, if you really look closely, the second cost turns out to be an improvement in GNP. Because if your car hits a rut and you have to take it to the garage to get fixed, the GNP goes up. So it's actually an improvement in the economy when the costs are transferred over to individuals. There's a lot of that goes on. And all of those things would have to be taken into account if we were giving an honest, accurate description of these effects. On the other hand, in Mexico, I think if you look closely, you find that the gross effects are not in doubt. There has been a very sharp decline in living standards for the majority of the population. And in many areas, a dangerous increase in pollution, especially around the maquiladora areas. There are places where doubtless things have improved for some people, as they had been doing before. And we have to know, we have to evaluate all of these effects. As to the effect of NAFTA, it was probably very limited. It's now conceded that the, if you take a look at the trade flows before and after NAFTA, trade did go up after NAFTA, but at roughly the rate it was going up before. There's very little change. And that's now conceded. All the projections are now admitted to have been false, and what is said right in the mainstream is, yeah, the purpose of NAFTA was to lock Mexico into the reforms. In fact, let me add something else which is less public. This was discussed in strategy sessions in Washington earlier, the minutes of which are public. There was a major meeting in Washington in 1990 of top decision makers and Mexico specialists and so on, talking about U.S.-Mexico relations. And they decided that relations were very healthy and very good, but there was one cloud on the horizon. The cloud was, I'm quoting it now, that a democracy opening in Mexico might bring into power a government with more nationalist and populist goals. Okay. Well, NAFTA stopped that. The main effect of NAFTA has not been increasing trade, but it's been decreasing the danger that a democracy opening might lead to that. So they can pick, say, populist leaders in Mexico City, but the virtual Senate of international investors under NAFTA-style arrangements ensures that they can't do very much, so there isn't any fear of a democracy opening. My own view is that's the main thing that lay behind NAFTA, as the World Trade Organization, as the coming agreement. Person who's got a PhD in linguistics be interested in poor people? I don't even understand that question. I mean, does taking a degree in linguistics remove your humanity? I mean,
no, it does not.
I hope not.
Yeah.
You shouldn't believe me. You should certainly not believe a word I said. That's why I was giving sources. Look them up. You shouldn't believe me or anyone else.
I would argue that a PhD does
often
remove your humanity.
It may, yeah, but it may, but it shouldn't. Yeah. $55
billion
to open up Korea to foreign ownership. Yeah, actually, but just in terms of scale, the bailout for Korea is not all that big. I mean, let's compare it with what's done here, say. The bailout of the SNLs, which is one minuscule, insignificant part of the U.S. economy, was four times the bailout of Korea. That's the biggest socialization in modern history. Was the taking the SNLs, which are like, you know, it's not like a central core piece of the U.S. economy. There's little banks that are, you know, giving out real estate mortgages. Bailing them out, meaning bailing them out, meaning bailing out wealthy investors who made bad loans and investments, that came a conservative estimate of that is about $200 billion. That was just distributed over U.S. taxpayers, because part of the system is that cost and risk are socialized, okay? That alone, that little piece, is four times Korea. Well, what's happening in South Korea, yesterday's New York Times had pretty good discussion of it on the business pages, not on the front pages. If you look in the business pages, there was a pretty good discussion, and what they pointed out was, yeah, the bailout is a bailout of mostly foreign investors and foreign banks and, you know, wealthy Koreans who made bad loans. In fact, the chief economist of the World Bank, Joseph Stiglitz, was quoted as saying, as being very much opposed to this, because what he's saying is all it's doing is telling investors there's no risk. So if they want to, you know, lend money with a chancy investment, well, you know, if it works, they make a lot of money. If they lose, it gets socialized. So remember that these are socialized. What the bailout, so-called bailout of South Korea, means you're paying for it, right? Even the stuff that comes from the World Bank is coming from taxpayers. So all of this stuff is being socialized, just like the third world debt was, to make sure that rich people don't have to face risks. And in fact, the, you know, the chief economist of the World Bank was just quoted on that yesterday. Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard, who's a big advocate of all this stuff, was also quoted saying the same thing. He's saying these were failures of private markets. It has nothing to do with government. These were failures in private markets, and now the public is being called upon to pay them off with the condition, crucial condition that you mentioned, that's very crucial. South Korea now has to agree to abandon the system which led to its phenomenal growth. South Korean growth rates have really been phenomenal, like nothing in the West. And they were done under a highly regulated state-centered system. As soon as they began to liberalize their financial institutions, they immediately started getting into trouble, just like Latin America. And now they are supposed to go the Latin American direction, sell out their resources, let foreigners own their industry, you know, let foreign banks decide what the social policy is going to be, cut down on wages, you know, cut back on security of employment. Yeah, that's what they're supposed to do in return for the public socializing the debts of the bad, paying off the bad debts of rich people. That's what it comes down to. But quite apart from what it amounts to, even the scale isn't so huge. As I say, it's about a quarter of the S&L. And that's a small part of the socialization of risk that goes on in the United States. Actually, it's not just the United States. There's the best study I know of, the only detailed study of transnationals by two British economists, investigated the top 100 transnationals in the Fortune list, you know, ranking them. And, you know, a long detailed analysis, they concluded that the top 100, every single one of them, first of all, they concluded that almost none of them were transnationals. They were based in a particular country, and that's where their markets were, and that's what they relied on for, you know, subsidy and so on. They also concluded that every one of the top 100 had benefited from state industrial policy in its own home country, and that more than 20 out of the 100 would not exist as business enterprises if it hadn't been for bailout by the home country. That incidentally includes Newt Gingrich's favorite, Lockheed, which was bailed out by a $2 billion loan guarantee when they started getting into trouble. So nothing special about South Korea, except that it's another form of socialization of risk and is being used as a lever to turn it into Mexico. Can't hear. Iran? You mean internally in Iran? Well, Iran did have a democratic opening back in the early 1950s, and they elected a conservative nationalist government, the Mossadegh government. That was overthrown by a U.S.-British military coup, put into power the Shah, who ruled the country in a very brutal fashion for up till 1979, but incidentally with economic growth. You know, it's another one of those brutal dictators who, for part of the population, was producing substantial growth and modernization. He was considered a great hero in the West. When he was overthrown, well, you got the Khomeini Revolution, and it's, which, you know, was very dictatorial and, you know, religious. I'm sure you're probably Iranian, I guess. Yeah, so you know 10 times as much about this as me. There's no point in my talking about it. But, I mean, that's been somewhat eroding. And I think there's now a lot of unpredictable, you tell me, but my feeling is there's a lot of unpredictable currents going in different directions in Iran, which are opening up the society. And so the society itself is much less fundamentalist than others that, like, say, Saudi Arabia. In fact, in many ways, it's less fundamentalist than the United States. The United States is one of the most religious fundamentalist countries in the world, you know. But they have a kind of clout, the religious authorities there, that they don't have here. But I think well, I'm interested in hearing what you say, but to me it looks like it's eroding. Yeah. But there's just a lot of things happening in the society. You know, there's a lot of cross currents, there's independence, you know, you see people publishing all kinds of things you wouldn't believe, and so on. Exactly where Iran's going to fit into the world system is a tricky story. The United States is trying very hard to isolate it, the United States and Israel, but they're alone in that. The United States and Israel are alone in trying to isolate Iran right now, and that, it doesn't look like they're getting away with it. Other countries are just, you know, breaking the rules.
Can I take
freedom? One more, and then freedom goes to leave.
Just one more question.
Well, maybe you can comment on the Harvard guided privatization of the former Soviet Union.
Well, the system was set up in such a way, and the Soviet Union is the original Third World. Now, that goes back to the 15th century. You go back to the 15th century, Eastern and Western Europe were sort of alike, and they started separating. The West began developing. The East became its service area. And the gap between the East and the West grew right up into early this century. The largest gap between the East and the West was around 1910. You know, it just kept going up until then. Well, in Eastern Europe was a deeply impoverished peasant society. It had sectors of wealth, mostly Western connected. It had, you know, artists and writers and, you know, an aristocracy who talked French and all the stuff we read about when, you know, we study Russian history. But it had a huge mass of people who were living in total misery, you know, and backwardness. Well, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution was, I don't think it had a thing to do with socialism or certainly not democracy. But it was a revolution of forced industrialization. And it carried out a quite brutal policy of forced industrialization, which turned the Soviet Union into a modern society. It's not third world. It's going back to third world. But through the 1980s, it was not a third world society. If you compare it with comparable, more or less comparable societies that we were running, it looks pretty good. So compare the Soviet Union with Brazil, let's say. Another big country with a lot of resources, you know, no enemies in that case, very much run by Western power, first the British, then us. For 10% of the population of Brazil, it's way better than living in the Soviet Union. For probably 90%, it's much worse than living in the Soviet Union. You know, in fact, if you look at their social indicators, they're about the level of Albania. You know. Well, okay, so the Soviet Union became a modern industrial society. There were things, it was beginning to stagnate around the 1960s for all kinds of reasons, which people debate. By the 1980s, it was still, the growth rate was going up, you know, still functioning. The upper classes in the Soviet Union, which is the state bureaucracy, you know, totalitarian state, it was run by a state bureaucracy, they essentially made the decision to dismantle it. Concluding, probably accurately for themselves, that they could do much better being like the wealthy sector in Mexico than being like the wealthy sector in Russia. They themselves could be. So they are returning the society to its third world status, meaning a sector of very great wealth, most of them old Communist Party apparatchiks, just like Yeltsin, you know, who essentially sold off the system. They are now becoming extremely wealthy, a kind of a mixture of the old state bureaucracy and new criminal elements and so on and so forth. Well, there's a huge flow of capital from Russia to the West. Capital flight is extraordinary. I mean, nobody knows exactly how to estimate it, but it's considered to be a measurable part of U.S. national income now. It's just capital flight from Russia, just like Mexico and Brazil and other countries where the rich people are free to, you know, make money by selling off the resources and then sending their money to the West. Most of the countries, for most of the population, it's been very harsh. By 1993, there were already estimated by the West by Western sources to be about 500,000 extra deaths a year just as a result of the economic reforms, which the West approves of. It's fairly substantial, you know. And so on across the board. I mean, very moving to a typical third world pattern. What is the Western role in this? Well, to implement it. You know? Yeah, of course. I mean, Western investors are very happy to see it go back to that. You can put a Volkswagen or General Motors or Fiat and so on can put up an assembly plant in former Eastern Europe at a fraction of the cost of what it costs for what the business press is quite frank about this. They say you can put up, I'm quoting, you can put up factories there for a fraction of the cost of what you have to pay the pampered Western workers. That's true. You don't have to pay them anything like what you pay the pampered Western workers, just the same as when you shift the assembly plant from Indiana to northern Mexico, you know. Yeah. And that's great for Western investors. It has the usual effects on the recipient society, you know, divides it into a sector of wealth, a large number of people who sort of get by if they can, superfluous people. And yes, the West has implemented it. The specific programs that were developed, say, Sachs's program, also were designed to break up the interactions among the countries of the Soviet system. You know, they had all kind of it was a closed economic system. And the idea was to set up what was called a hub-and-spoke system, so each Eastern European country would have independent relations with the West, not with one another. And the early effect of that was a very serious attack on the whole economic system. That's incidentally now rebuilding. Those links are coming back to some extent. But essentially it was subjected to the same kinds of neoliberal structural adjustment programs as Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa, with pretty similar effects. Again, you have to disaggregate. I mean, Eastern Europe was not a homogeneous area. Parts of it were part of the West, like, say, the Czech Republic. And that was a rich Western industrial society, and it'll, with various, you know, failures and so on, it'll probably move back to that. Same's true of Western Poland, which is really part of Germany. But Estonia will become part of Finland, you know, a rich industrial society. But by and large, it's more or less restoring what it was before the move towards independence.